Thank you, Michael. So I'm Eric, and I'm a postdoc at Los Alamos. I work with Paul Johnson in the geophysics group, but I'm also supported by the Center for Nonlinear Studies there. And this is some work that's been done in collaboration, in addition with Paul, with one of our collaborators at Los Alamos, Robert Geyer, and Chris Marone at Penn State, whose data we're going to be using here. Okay, so the goal here is to try and investigate the physics of stick slip and shear granular materials. And there's a lot of reasons why one might be interested in stick slip. For me, one of the big reasons is that it's the closest laboratory analog we have to the seismic cycle. That is, there's both periods of slow loading, like in the Earth, during the interseismic period between earthquakes. There's slow plate motion, plate tectonics that loads up faults, and then they fail very rapidly during earthquakes. And so that's similar to the dynamics that we see of a stick slip in the laboratory. In particular, I'm going to look at how various aspects of a lab data with stick slip scale with the experimental conditions. And this includes varying things like normal stress, the thickness of the layer that we're shearing, and the rate at which it's being sheared. And part of the reason why I'm really interested in all this is because all of these experimental conditions in the lab are very different from what natural faults experience in the Earth. And so it's very important to know what might be different as we go from lab experiments to Earth in trying to come up with models of what's going on when materials fail in the Earth. One particular thing I'm going to focus on is dilation of the layer. And we're going to find that that plays a very important role in the failure process. We're going to look at scaling to try and understand some of the basic physics of dilation and failure in materials. And the last thing is I'm going to try and make some connections between constitutive laws and what we observe in the Earth to try and understand implications that may have for the Earth and deformation and failure in there. Okay, so once again, stick slip instability. So here's an example from an experiment. Is there a pointer here? Yes.
This would be clear if we turn on.
Yeah, turn off the front light.
So, how do we?
We can try to
spin up. Okay. Is this better?
I think you did the wrong one. No, it's the door here.
We need to get somebody really big.
Keep those there.
All right, well, I guess this is what we'll have to view it here. Here's an example of some stick slip from a lab experiment. So this is showing one cycle of the stick slip. And so I see as initially the material starts out here and it's stuck. So as it's sheared, due to elastic loading, the shear stress begins to increase. And then as the shear stress increases, then the material begins to creep and fail. And so this curve begins to turn over due to that. And then eventually there's a slip and a failure event. There's a very rapid drop in the shear stress, and then the cycle begins again. And so this is something that's observed in lots of different situations, like experiments. There are discrete element microscopic type simulations that people do to look at stick slip. This is a picture of where inelastic deformation is occurring in a stick slip cycle. This is some simulation data that I got from Michele Griffa at EMPA. And this is just showing where there's inelastic deformation. And then there's also constitutive models that exhibit stick slip dynamics. So part of the question here is to try and connect between all these different approaches and try and understand implications that experiments and, say, discrete element simulations have for constitutive laws, coming up with simplified models that can capture some of these important dynamics that are observed in these types of instabilities. And I just want to mention that I'm focusing on granular materials here. As Michael said, there's probably very many similarities between these instabilities and these events and things like glasses and other amorphous materials. And thanks to the laboratory, I know that my computer is now virus-free. So just to illustrate, there's many different materials that may have similarities with these instabilities in granular materials. things like colloids and emulsions, biological tissues, glasses, granular materials like sand, fault materials, grains, and foams. All these are this wide class of systems where there's particles or grains or atoms that form a non-crystalline structure in these materials. And so trying to understand the dynamics of granular materials certainly has an impact for understanding what's going on in a much larger scope in terms of materials failure. Okay, so how do we understand the dynamics of these materials? Well, we can do an experiment, for instance. So here, this is an image from Bob Berenger's group where they're looking at granular materials. And so this is an experiment that includes 2D photoelastic disks, and they're placed in a Couette cell, and the center wheel is turned. And due to the photoelastic nature of these particles, we're able to image force chains in force networks throughout the material and try to understand how granular materials support stress. And so you can also image particle displacements in these 3D materials, and that gives you an idea of the deformation that's occurring here. So given that, we can try and come up with ways to describe it theoretically. Often that's done in terms of simulations. So here, this is a picture from some of Michael Falk's simulations. So this is a two-dimensional molecular dynamics simulation of a glass. It's under tensile strain, so these two ends of the material pulled in this direction. And these blue regions show where inelastic plastic deformation is occurring in the material. And what tends to happen in these is we get a nice shear band that forms through the material, and so there's resulting a shear across this. So this allows us to come up with a microscopic understanding what's going on in the materials, and we can connect it back with some experiments. But now let's say, okay, well, we want to look at a much larger system like a fault in the Earth. Well, the problem is we can't do a simulation like this because it has very limited length and time scales that we can look at. You can't simulate every single grain in an earthquake fault. That would get out of hand very quickly. So we want to instead develop some sort of a constitutive model that captures some of these microscopic observations. Okay, well, what are some of the examples of constitutive laws that people use? Well, since I've done a lot of work in the seismology world, the very favorite model that seismologists use is the laboratory-derived Dietrich-Arena friction laws. So this is usually best illustrated by what's known as a velocity step experiment. So you imagine you have a frictional interface, a material, something that you're shearing at a constant rate, V1 initially, and so we're at some steady state value of the friction. And then very suddenly right here at this instant, I'm going to increase the velocity up to some larger value, V2. So there's going to be a transient evolution of the friction. So initially there's this increase, that's quantified by some parameter A, and then over some characteristic length scale, the friction evolves to some new value that's quantified by A minus B. And so these parameters A and B and L are just something that seismologists tend to fit from data. So there's not a whole lot of physical insight that gains from this. So most of the physical understanding of these Dietrich-Arena type friction laws come from lab experiments that look at asperity contacts. So this is an experiment where they have some glass plates that are roughened, and they shine light through there and are able to image the time evolution of the asperity contacts on the surface. And they observe some time evolution of that and are able to connect it to some of the history dependence of friction they observe here. But this is also very phenomenological and doesn't give us a whole lot of physical insight into what's going on here. And the problem with that is that the conditions in these lab experiments are usually very, very different from those in the Earth. So for instance, the compressive stresses that are applied on the materials in the lab are typically something like 5 megapascals, while it's maybe a factor of 20 larger, 100 megapascals in the Earth. That's a very big difference. We have thicker layers. Usually you can look at something on the order of millimeters thick in the laboratory, while natural faults can be meters thick in terms of the layer of granular material in there. We have very different driving rates. In the laboratory, we're talking about microns per second versus centimeters per year, which is the rate at which the San Andreas fault is being driven. So we're on the LA side of the San Andreas fault. We're moving north. North, it's a couple centimeters per year. On the San Francisco side, on the other side of San Andreas, they're moving south at several centimeters per year.
Relative to what?
Relative to each other.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so they can measure the relative, through geodetic measurements, they can measure the relative displacements on either side of the fault. So basically, the idea is that we don't know what's going to be different when we're at these conditions that are very different from the laboratory. So if you're just fitting data to try and come up with your model, you know, that's maybe not the best idea.
Sorry,
yeah, question?
I want to respond a bit more. Do A, B, and L depend on V1 and V2?
No, they do not. So these are usually the Dietrich-Corino friction captures a logarithmic rate dependence, and so these A and A minus B parameters quantify. If you change, the log of the take the log of the velocity change, then that tells you these parameters are tell you the change in the friction coefficient.
So logarithmic rate dependence of the stress. So the stress goes.
The stress goes logarithmic with the velocity.
Yes. Velocity.
Yes.
So wait. So it does depend on the velocity.
So these parameters. So if you change the velocity by a factor of 10, A tells you, how much that, and that doesn't depend on the velocity. But depending on the velocity, you use the logarithm of the velocity.
So A and B are functions of the ratio of V1 and V2.
Yes, that's right. Any other questions? Okay, well, what about in physics? If we try and come with something that's a little more physical, something that's often used in physics is SDZ theory. Since we're at Santa Barbara, it's often a useful thing to talk about. So this is a it's a nod to Jim there. And Michael's here as well, so. So this is a picture from of a simulation of a Leonard Jones glass done by Michael and Jim. This is sort of the classic picture of one of these shear transformation zones, or these soft spots that arise when these amorphous materials are sheared. So the idea is we have this packing of these glassy particles here, and they're being shear stress is applied. And as the shear stress is applied, there's some irreversible plastic deformation that's occurring here. And so if we focus on these four particles right here, initially notice these two small particles are neighbors. And then after it's been sheared, now these two small particles are no longer neighbors, and the large particle and the small particle are now neighbors. And so that's that neighbor switching is a hallmark of this inelastic, irreversible plastic deformation that's occurring in the material. So the idea is that instead of keeping track of the position and momentum of every single particle in here, we can simplify things and still have capture some of these observations and experiments, or even by simulations, by keeping track of the number of these soft spots, these SDZs, these flow defects in the material. And that will tell us, how the material responds to things like stress and as we drive it in this case. And so basically what happens in the model for SDZ theory is that these regions are constantly being created and destroyed as the material is being sheared. And so the way the material accumulates a net plastic strain is that one of these zones comes up in this configuration, then due to the applied shear, it changes its orientation, it rearranges to this configuration. Then this one is destroyed due to continued shearing that stirs up the particles. And then a new one comes up in this orientation, it flips, it's destroyed, and the new one comes up here, it flips, and it's destroyed. And that cycle continues on and on, allows the material to accumulate plastic strain. So what we need to do is, instead of keeping track of every single particle here, we just need to know how many of these SDZs we have and how frequently they're rearranged from one orientation to the other. So that's something that's summarized here by this equation. So it's gamma dot, this is the plastic strain rate of the material. And this is a function of both the stress and the packing of the material, which we quantify through an effective temperature chi. So this effective temperature differs from the thermal temperature. The thermal temperature describes kinetic degrees of freedom in the material, while this effective temperature governs configurational degrees of freedom. That is how we arrange the particles on the packing of this material. And so basically, this effective temperature, we have a Boltzmann distribution, tells us the number of SDZs that we have. So if we have a larger configurational disorder in the material, there's going to be more SDZs. And then the stress is in here, which determines the rate at which these SDZs rearrange. So if you increase the shear stress that you apply, that just means that these STZs are going to change configuration at a higher rate.
What energy do you put into the exponent?
Pardon?
What energy do you, energy scale do you put into the exponent?
So in this case, the effective temperature is normalized by the energy of forming an STZ. So this would be, so if you were to write this in a dimensional respect, this would be the energy of formation of STZ divided by Boltzmann constant times the effective temperature. So we normalize it in this manner.
Can one measure this energy?
I'm no expert in that, but yeah. Okay, so basically this STZ theory is nice because it's able to capture a lot of the same experimental observations from the Dietrich-Grena law, and it also includes other things that are important for deformation materials like strain localization. So for instance, this is a plot of the plastic strain rate as a function of position in a material using STZ theory, and as it's sheared, on the plastic strain rate, you can see, is very localized to this narrow region in space. So that means that the deformation is only occurring on this narrow region rather than throughout the entire material. So in using STZ theory practically, we have to come up with some sort of evolution equation for the effective temperature. So usually it's assumed that it follows a heat equation. In this model here, there's both terms for dissipation. So the idea is that you dissipate energy in the material, you're stirring up the particles, you're driving them towards some steady state value of the effective temperature. There's also diffusion. So for instance, diffusion we see in simulations of a glass. So this is a plot of the potential energy, which we're taking as a proxy for the effective temperature. Regions where the potential energy is higher, the particles are going to be further apart, and they're going to be more disordered in that case. And as you see, as the simulation progresses, there's a diffusion of the effective temperature. So it's nice that we have lots of simulation data to use to come up with these descriptions of how the effective temperature evolves, but there's less connections with experiments. So one of my goals here is to try and improve this link between these more physical constitutive laws, such as STZ theory, and experimental data. So you might ask, well, why should we care about this? What are some, maybe Dietrich-Grena is just fine. Well, there's some important differences that arise when you compare Dietrich-Grena with STZ theory. It primarily relates to this frictional length scale that comes about. So this is some constant value you get from your experiment when you're fitting your data for your Dietrich-Grena law. But this is something that's also predicted by your evolution equation for, like, say, your effective temperature in STZ theory. And so we can look, there's some lab data that measure how this this length scale varies with the velocity at which you're driving the material. So for instance, you see that there's definitely an evolution in some of the friction data here, and the predictions of STZ theory, which is given by this dark curve here, where the x's, seems to capture some of the important rate variations in this length scale. But there also might be some scaling with the normal stress or the thickness that's not, hasn't been thoroughly explored here. So we need to look more closely to determine what some of the other differences between some other things in friction that may not be captured by Dietrich-Grena.
Quick question. I thought L depended on the ratio of V1 to V2.
Oh, no. So L does not depend on that. That's only these A and B parameters that tell you how the steady state values of the friction evolve. Well, this length scale is something that's different. That doesn't depend on the velocity at all in the Dietrich-Grena model. Okay, and why should we care about this length scale being different as a function of slip rate? Well, for me, that's important because if you're looking at an earthquake simulation, some of the small scale physics that you put into your constitutive law can have large scale effects on earthquake simulation. So for instance, this is some simulations I did comparing STZ theory with Dietrich-Grena, and one of the important quantities that arises in earthquake simulation is the peak slip rate, that is how fast the fault is slipping, because that's partly what's going to determine the large-scale ground motion that's going to be occurring when there's an earthquake. And so just by changing how this length scale depends on the slip rate, you see differences, but maybe a factor of 1.5 times larger slip rates with your Dietrich-Grena friction instead of STZ theory. So, capturing just something as simple as this small little length scale, how it varies, can have larger scale impacts on earthquake, coming up with earthquake hazard models if you use a different friction law. So it's important to try and use, put some physics into this. We know that what we're putting into our earthquake earthquake simulations makes some physical sense.
Can I ask one more question about the L? So the L is presumably just a reflection of the time it takes for the stress to relax?
Well, it's the length scale. So
it's a time scale?
Yeah, it's a length scale rather than a time scale. So it really does depend. So if you drive it faster, it changes the time scale that it's occurring. So it's definitely, usually it's interpreted as some sort of typical length scale for asperity contacts on rough surfaces.
Are you going to talk more about how you get this length scale out of constituent models?
I can.
Okay. Well, if you're not going to talk about it later, can you? I mean, because in SDZ theory, we don't. It's a constituent model, so you're not putting in a length scale per se.
Yeah, so basically what you do is you have some, like, so if we go back, we have this evolution equation for the effective temperature. So if we're using this effective temperature as our state variable, something that quantifies the history dependence of friction. So as if we monitor the evolution of the effective temperature, and that tells us how the friction is going to evolve on similar length and time scales. So basically, from this, if we do a velocity step experiment with SDZ theory, then given the evolution of that, we can extract a length scale out of that, and based on that, that's how you calculate this for random friction laws, rather than just Dieter-Greener, where it's just some parameter that you put in there. Does that address what I can? Yeah.
For those kinds of calculations, is the diffusivity like important or not?
It depends on, so if you're doing a simulation of an entire width of this material, so there's two length scales that come in. There's the entire width material and this diffusion length scale that comes in there. So depending on the ratio of those two, if this diffusion length scale is much smaller, this entire width, then this becomes the important length scale. If they're similar, then localization doesn't play a big role, and the entire width is an appropriate proxy for the right length scale for what's.
M.D doesn't have the dimensions of a length.
So this is a length squared. So gamma dot tells you the time scale for diffusion, and this d is a squared length scale. It tells you typically what these width of these shear bands tend to be in your simulations.
Absolute value of gamma dot.
Oh yeah. So this is, so usually when I do earthquake things, it doesn't slip backwards due to large tectonic stresses. But yes, in the case of something where there may be some backslip, yeah, you're going to want to use the absolute value of your strain rate there.
In the next slide, you mentioned agreement with experiments. Are these friction experiments or?
Like these? Yes, these are friction experiments on layers of glass beads that are sheared at varying rates. And so using this, they're able to measure what these length scale is as a function of.
Is it friction between two surfaces?
No, it's of a layer of glass beads that are being sheared. Or this one actually may be of sand, I think, actually. But it's some sort of granular material that has some net thickness that's being sheared.
Can I ask a quick question? Can I go back to the previous slide?
Sure.
So I'm confused. So if chi was a kinetic temperature, then the concept of dissipation and this equation makes intuitive sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a configurational temperature. So can you explain the meaning of this red term?
This red term?
Yes. So what kind of dissipation? Chi is it's not just average velocity squared. It's some.
Yeah, so it's configurational, so it depends on how you pack the materials. So the idea is that as you dissipate energy, that you're going to be stirring up these particles and they're exploring different configurations. And so that's what allows it to evolve to this new effective temperature, that it, new steady state value that it wants to reach.
So if D is just a phenomenological parameter in this model, the square root of D is the length scale, I don't see any gamma dot dependence.
Don't see any gamma dot dependence.
You said that in STZ theory, the length scale depends on shear rate.
Yes.
But the length scale is not the relevant shear rate.
Yeah.
It's not the relevant shear rate. That diffusion constant can be in most circumstances just factor that we ignore. It's not clear whether it's needed just to make the mathematics smooth. It does not determine either the width of the shear band or anything else.
So that's not the
important. Well, it does in some cases, Jim. Jim, it does in some cases. Depends on your parameter space.
Actually, not in Michael's simulations.
Yeah.
In these simulations, the diffusion term can, it basically just allows it to be smoothly going down from the peak, but
yeah.
Otherwise doesn't affect it.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you really drive it hard so that you get the turn it into a shear fracture, then that term becomes important. But then we need more experiments anyway.
All right, any other questions on this? Okay. Okay, so now that I've sort of given a rather cursory introduction to SCZ theory, our goal now is to look at laboratory stick slip to try and address some of these questions that we had about deformation and failure. So your question is, can we provide any constraints on the physics that should be going into these constitutive models based on these experiments? You know, can we say anything about the evolution of effective temperature or free volume from the experiments? You know, does this form that Jim has come up with, you know, make sense based on experimental data? And finally, are there any implications for earthquakes? Okay, so the data that I'm using here is from Chris Marone's lab at Penn State. And here's a basic schematic of their experimental setup. They have three different blocks, and these granular layers, they're comprised of spherical glass beads, are sandwiched between each of these layers. And then from the side, constant applied normal stress goes on them. And then the center block is then pushed down at a constant rate V naught. So this is what I call the load point. So as this is pushed down at a constant rate, it sticks and slips as it's being forced down due to the friction exerted by these granular layers. So this load point rate is moved at a constant value. For most of the experiments I'm going to look at, it's 5 microns per second. And there's also a couple experiments I have where there's a varying rate, but I haven't fully finished analyzing those because they're noisy and there's other challenges. So a lot of the data I'm going to look at is just from this constant load point rate. They have able to apply variable normal stress from the side, so usually it varies between 2 and 8 megapascals. And they also have a variable thickness throughout an experiment, and that's due to a geometric effect. Is as you push this down, these layers tend to thin, and so if you look at the end of the experiment, we have thinner granular layers than we did at the beginning. So it allows us to compare some of the effects of varying the thickness of the layer throughout the experiment.
What are the typical thicknesses?
Typical thicknesses are on the order of millimeters. So I think most of the data I have has 4 millimeter thickness. And so that's many, many bead diameters. So these are 125 microns, or the glass beads that are used. So there's many beads that consist of one of these layers.
And the beads are all dispersed?
They're fairly monodispersed. I think it ranges from 100 microns to 150. So they're fairly monodispersed, but there's some variation due to how they're manufactured. So this plot here shows a typical experiment. And this is one where there's a variable normal stress applied. So throughout the experiment, as this load point is pushed down, so as this point is driven downward, they have a constant normal stress, takes on several different values throughout. It starts out at 2 megapascals, then goes 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2. And so as we see throughout the experiment, there's stick slip at all these different normal stresses. You notice one thing is that in these earlier parts, stick slip is more irregular, while it becomes very regular at these larger values of normal stress. Because it becomes very regular here, I'm going to focus most of my analysis on these upper ones, and
how's the normal stress being varied?
It's varied just by with the load that's applied by some piston.
What's the history of it?
At each of these steps, it's constant in time, and it's varied from 2 to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 megapascals.
Steps are being imposed.
Yes. Yes. By from the side by the experimental apparatus. So the hope is that by looking at getting statistics on these stick slips at these varying normal stresses, for instance, we can examine some of the scaling properties that they have. Okay, so in the experiment, we measure a couple things. We measure the shear stress that you have to apply in order to force down the center block at this constant rate. And because a constant pressure is applied from the side, this layer is going to dilate and compact, and so we can measure changes on the layer thickness. And so here's a typical picture of one of these stick slip cycles. As I mentioned before, it starts out, it's stuck, and then due to elastic loading, as we push down on the center piston, the shear stress increases. And then once the shear stress increases, then the material begins to creep, and then eventually once it reaches a peak in the shear stress, it slips, and there's this failure event, and there's a very rapid drop in shear stress before the cycle starts over again.
Do we know that the material is actually creeping there, or is that just an interpretation due to the fact?
That's an interpretation.
That's when you're running backwards.
What?
Because before the sticks.
Right. So we're talking with Chris about doing some careful experiments throughout these cycles to try and get at the question of what's exactly going on there. But that's something they haven't measured yet. But it's certainly something we're interested in exploring more.
You're assuming that because the displacements are large, is that?
Yeah. Yeah. And the other reason that we're assuming that is because if we look at the layer thickness, we see that here's a typical evolution. So it starts out, and while it's stuck, there's no evolution in the layer thickness. And then once it begins, once this curve begins to turn over, we begin to see this dilation. And so that's presumably because there's some inelastic deformation that's going on in the material. And then once it begins to dilate, then eventually it reaches the peak value, and then it compacts once there's a slip event.
Can you tell whether the transition from stick to creep is a sharp transition, or is there always a little bit of creep and it's just gradually increasing?
There's always a little bit, but it's definitely there's definitely a very sharp difference between these slip events and what goes on.
No, I'm talking about between stick and creep.
Between stick and creep. So, in like this part of the regime.
What I'm wondering is there another step in there that you're not seeing where you go from, is there some finite time over which the material is just distorting elastically, and then at some point it actually starts to flow.
So that's something that we were not 100% sure of, but
get that from cycles, right?
Yeah. So they have. I haven't. So if you look at this, you start to see acoustic emission once you get up into these higher values. That's another indication that there's some rearrangement and deformation that's occurring there, rather than maybe some softening or something that may be going on there.
Statistics of that would be interesting too.
Peary have been looking at that. That's something that we're interested in looking at from the experiments as well. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Okay. No problem.
It's really so regular. Like if I look at the depth, the stress drops.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a distribution of the stress drops, it's essentially a very narrow.
They're very regular, and there are some variations. Trying to remember if I have a plot that shows six. I probably do, even in my own stuff. I can show you that later. If
it took really long times when the layer thickness started to change by an appreciable fraction, the picture would have to change.
Pardon?
Eventually, if you keep going like this and the layer keeps getting thinner every time you have a big slip event, eventually you're going to be doing an experiment on a system with a much thinner layer. And so if anything depends on the thickness of that layer, the picture of the shear stress as a function of time.
Yeah, so you don't see, if you go back one, we visit the same normal stress again later on. They look very similar between the beginning and the end. So it tells you there are some things that.
In this experiment, you haven't really changed the thickness by very much.
Another factor of two, maybe.
That doesn't seem consistent with the data you showed on the next transparency of this one.
Oh, you're talking about within from one. So I'm talking about from beginning experiment to the end of the experiment. You visit the same normal stress again, and the cycles look very similar at the end versus the beginning when there's a much larger change in the thickness.
So each one of these plateaus is actually a series of.
Yeah, each one of these is a series of many sticks of events.
They're just a very small scale.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is your driving apparatus much stiffer than the layer itself?
Yes. So this is something. not 100% familiar with all the details of the apparatus, but there's some load cell up there that's very stiff that they use to apply the shear stress at the top of this. But there is some finite stiffness to the apparatus itself. It's not completely stiff. So there are some compliance of the apparatus in addition to the elastic behavior of these grains that we're shearing.
How much damage you have on the grain?
There's very little change in terms of comminuting and fracturing grains because we're at relative to earthquakes, relatively low normal stresses. So if you look at there is some fracture that occurs, but it's not an appreciable amount during the course of the experiment.
So do you interpret the behavior at the very end of that experiment where it's not sticking anymore in the last two as something has changed, things just blowing? Or,
Probably. So you notice that to these low normal stresses, it's very irregular. And so there may be more appreciable differences between changed layer thickness than that you see at these larger values of normal stress. So that's certainly a possibility.
Could you explain once again the apparent zigzag, very dense zigzag patterns in each of these steps?
So within each of these, so this picture shows a close-up of zooms in time on one of the individual stick slips. So each of these little vertical lines is a stick slip event. And so this is just zooming in more closely and looking at the time evolution of the shear stress. So at each value of the normal stress, there's many, many of these that occur.
And it's not periodic in time.
When it's regular stick slip, it's very regular, actually.
So in the previous picture, it looked like there was some irregularity.
Yeah, so that's only at the low normal stresses. At the larger values, it's very regular.
And if your period is independent of the amount of stress that you apply?
It's not. I'll show that in a second.
Oh, I see. So you're going to show us like how the period change or like the mean period change?
Yeah.
So it's acting like a violin string.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, as far as Karam is concerned, yes.
Okay. So, given these measurements we make, how can we get out some of the additional things we need, like slip? So this, of course, requires us to make some assumptions since we haven't measured exactly everything here. But what I assume is the stress evolution follows this equation here. So the time derivative of the shear stress, there's elastic loading through the load point velocity. So that's some stiffness times the rate at which the center block is pushed downward. And then inelastic deformation is quantified by this slip rate V that releases the shear stress. So given this ignores inertia of the center block, which for most of the experiments can be ignored. Some of the ones at higher rates you can't, which makes the analysis of that more complicated. But most of the stuff I'm looking at here, this is a fairly good assumption. So basically, we know the velocity, because it's something we imposed in the experiment. During each stick slip cycle, we can determine the stiffness just by doing a linear fit of the shear stress as a function of time. And that allows us to get the stiffness for each individual event. So that's something that may vary with the normal stress. We know the stress is measured as a function of time, so we can just differentiate that. Therefore, we can calculate what the velocity is and then integrate that to get the slip. So that is the net plastic deformation that's occurring as a function of time in these experiments. Okay, so a basic question you can ask is, what determines when failure occurs? So we can say, well, maybe it's probably just the friction coefficient. So we plot the shear stress divided by normal stress. This on the left here, this is for the data at 4 megapascals. So it shows stick slip occurs. But there's a little bit of chatter and some sliding that occurs at the top of each of these curves before a failure event. Well, if you compare that to the data at 8 megapascals of normal stress, you see different behavior. It gets up here, and then it fails much sooner relative to this, where we see much longer time spent sliding at this plateau. So what this tells us is the system can slide at the failure stress and not fail immediately at least here at 4 megapascals. And so notice that this changes the frequency of failure. It's lower here by about a factor of 2. So here we have 4 stick flips, and here we have about 8. So this tells us that the shear stress is not telling us the whole story, and that we are instead going to look at the internal state of the material through changes in the thickness to try and complement this picture to understand what that is going on in the experiment. Okay, so this is a plot of the layer thickness as a function of load point displacement. So that is just the displacement of the center block in the experiment. What we see is that, once again, there's this dilation phase during when the material is creeping, followed by compaction when it fails. So I can say, well, I'm just going to calculate what the change in thickness is for every single stick slip event throughout the experiment and see what that, how that looks. And so if you plot this dilation prior to failure, so just the difference between this minimum value and this maximum value as a function of normal stress, you see there isn't very much variation in that as a function of normal stress. There's much more scatter within each individual value of the normal stress than there is throughout the experiment. So this tells us that the internal, obviously, first is that the internal configuration of the material is important for failure. There's some set amount of dilation that appears to be necessary in order to get the material to fail, and that it's, this tells us it's independent of the normal stress.
Question there. Yep. Is that kink on the coming down just because it takes the load a moment to realize that it's
right here?
Overshoot sort of when it slips.
Why does it go backwards? Yeah, it's okay.
So it basically takes some time for it to catch up.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of inertia in there, but it's you know, it's only a small amount relative to this total amount of displacement.
So the experimental setup is at the beginning symmetric because you have 2 layers.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you have 2 thicknesses.
Yeah.
Do they really track each other?
Oh, this is an aggregate of the two summed together here.
So if you look at the individual ones.
I'm not sure if they can measure those because they have just one piston applied from the side, and they measure the deflection of that in order to calculate the change, to measure the change in thickness. So I'm not sure that they can measure that. But it certainly would be something interesting if they could to look at that. Any other questions?
How much do you actually resolve on the way down?
There's usually 2 or 3 data points, so not a whole lot. There is some data that is at much higher frequency that I haven't looked at yet. So it may be that looking at that, you can resolve more of what's going on. But most of what I'm talking about here is during this dilation phase where you do have a lot of data. So it's clear what's going on in the material.
Those numbers are real microns?
Yes.
So they're tiny compared to
Yes, they're much smaller than a grain diameter.
2 orders of magnitude.
Yeah, we're talking about maybe 5%, 50% of a grain diameter. So you only need very small changes in the thickness in order to get this to fail. Okay, well, what about looking at the scaling of this dilation as a function of thickness? So this is a plot of thickness as a function of, or dilation prior to failure. And just, once again, we can see that there's not a whole lot of variation with thickness here. There's typically more scatter at a given thickness than there is as we vary the thickness. This also tells us that the dilation is independent of the thickness. And this is pretty good evidence that we were having some sort of localization of this plastic deformation. Because if the entire layer was participating in this, you would expect that this amount of dilation should scale with layer thickness. So that's an interesting observation. And it's nice because we can observe these particles directly due to the experimental setup. So we have to use indirect methods like this to try and get at what's going on inside the material. However, there is some rate dependence of this dilation prior to failure. So this is an experiment that varies the driving velocity. And we can see that there's a very clear trend in this amount of dilation. At higher rates, you tend to see less dilation prior to failure. So this implies that this internal configuration material evolves to some value that seems to depend on the strain rate, but not on the thickness or the normal stress. So that kind of reiterates the idea that there's some rate-dependent effective temperature that you might evolve towards, but not dependent on some of the other quantities. Yeah, Lisa?
Sorry, I was just thinking about your comment on the last slide. So I'm not convinced yet that it has to be localization based on the data, because I could imagine that simply the particles are moving further apart if I have a thinner layer, perhaps.
Okay.
Well, I mean, that would be slightly weird, right? But it would be nice to know if, I mean, is there any way to tell if, you could imagine, right, that the reason the dilation is the same is just because the particles move further apart if the layer is thinner.
It's thinner, there's, okay, yeah. Well, that's certainly a possibility. And yeah, pending measurements, that's hard to resolve. But
how much of a range of the dilation did you have again?
Oh, sorry. No, no problem.
So what, I would expect that to asymptote, right? If we got to a certain point where it was super, super thick or super, super thin.
Well, I mean, once again, this is much less than an individual grain diameter. Okay. So in order to get to the point where that might asymptote to something, you probably need to be, you know, very, very thin layers, or very, very, that we don't tend to see in these experiments. Okay, so now that we know that there's something going on with this this dilation, we're going to look more at the dynamics of this thickness evolution. So first question we can ask is, well, what controls the evolution? Is it slip or is it time? And so left here, this is the plot of layer thickness, it's a function of time, and we see that there's, you know, mostly as a linear phase of this this dilation. But when we plot instead layer thickness as a function of slip, we get a much nicer plot here that shows that, yeah, there's definitely a linear trend of this thickness as a function of slip. So it indicates that the dilation rate is controlled by slip, or the inverse plastic strain rate. You're telling us what the time scale is that tells us how this layer thickness evolves. So once we're looking back at our STZ theory, that formula, it says that the plastic strain rate is the right time scale to be having here.
Okay, so it's noticeable if you look at the plot as a function of slip that there's a lot more regions. Right.
When you
this looks like a sort of piecewise thing with at least 1, 2, 3, 4 different regions that repeat.
Those might just be data points, right?
Yeah, these are individual data points. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So during a slip event, we only resolve 2 or 3 data points. So yeah, if you have 3 points in there, it's going to look like So that's just an artifact of the sampling rate of the data. Okay. So. So now we want to look at, you know, how does this dilation rate with slip scale? You know, how does it depend on things like the normal stress or the thickness? And this is a question that's certainly relevant for earthquake modelers, because they often include phenomenological fits to data in deriving models of how porosity evolves in fault gouge. And so once again, these don't include much physical motivation. So we can look at this quantitatively now with this experiment. So basically what we have here, layer thickness is a function of slip. For every stick slip event, we do a linear fit of this portion of the curve in order to get the dilation rate. And then we can plot that, say, as a function of normal stress. And there's a very nice linear trend that arises out of that. So it shows that the rate of energy dissipation is what's important for dilation here. So as you do more inelastic work, the material, it stirs up these grains and they form less dense configurations. So you know that having some dissipation rate here in our constitutive law, it makes some sense based on what we're seeing here in the experimental data. Okay, well, what about thickness? So this is a plot of the dilation with slip with the normal stress dependence that I showed in the last slide removed, and now plotted as a function of layer thickness, and this is on a log-log scale. You can see that much of the data falls on a line of a slope minus 1 here. So it tells us that the dilation rate should scale approximately inversely with the layer thickness. And interesting thing to note is now, I pointed out before that the actual amount of dilation does not depend on the thickness. But there is something aspect of the dynamics that does depend on the thickness, and that is this dilation rate. So there's probably both full layer dynamics and localized dynamics occurring within the same experiment here, which is interesting.
What is all the scatter? I'm not sure what you're...
Like down here?
How you're deciding if that looks...
So a lot of these ones at the end are funny because, so you notice that, I don't have a plot of that. So the layer is thinning throughout the entire experiment. So at some points, the overall thinning rate, if that's comparable to the amount of dilation that you're getting, you're not going to see a whole lot of that. So there's a couple of data points. It's right at the beginning and right at the end. Or for instance, with the irregular stick slip, there's a long period of sliding in those cases, and there tends to be some compaction during those long periods of sliding. And so if I count that as a stick slip event, then there's going to be some net negative negative change in the dilation rate. So those are obviously not even beyond this plot because it's logarithmic.
So those but X's are all the stick slip events on the way up and the way down, mm-hmm. Most of them, yeah. Especially once during the period.
Once you get in the periodic regime, which is, so you notice that this is at the very edge and the very end, which would be at the beginning and the end of the experiment. We're in the more irregular regime. So a lot of those, and so there's fewer of those stick slip events in the statistics. So most of them in the regular part are going to be falling in this region right here.
But that the width of that region is a tiny fraction of a decade.
Yes. Yeah, so I know Chris has some data where they've started with thicker layers. So this is nice because you can do it throughout one experiment and so not have any of the systematic variations between different experiments. But he does have some data where they have maybe I think they may get to an order of magnitude. No, I don't even think they can get to an order of magnitude difference.
They'll have the same
slope. I need to look at that. But yeah, so certainly I know that, this is not a huge range in layer thickness. And certainly trying to extrapolate this to very large thicknesses, we should be cautious about that. But try and get some of the physics out of this, and then you maybe think, take a step back before trying to extrapolate. So the way I like to think about this is an idea from one of Chris's papers with Jen Anthony. And that's the idea is that the length of the force chains in the material are what's important for this dilation rate. So you can imagine as we're shearing a granular material, we need to both support the shear stress that we're applying and accommodate the relative displacements that we're imposing at the boundaries. So if you have very thin layers, we're going to have short force chains across here. And so in order for, if we try and shear this without dilating, these chains have to bend a whole lot and they become unstable. So instead, there's kind of you can think of this as a rigid rotation of these force chains that require the material to dilate in order to both support the stress that you're applying and accommodate this deformation at the boundaries. And if we have longer chains, there's more points along their length in which they can bend and deform. So they can bend a little bit more and don't have to dilate as much in order to get them to both accommodate the slip and support the shear stress. Now, I should point out this is very simple cartoon, and force structures in granular materials are much more complicated than this. This is sort of telling the idea that the length of these force chains may be what's responsible for this scanning that we see here.
That length presumably depends on your normal stress.
Yeah, definitely
it's
also.
Not just the size.
Yeah, that's right. So as you apply larger normal stress, there's going to be a change in the force network, and that's also going to have an effect on how it dilates. That's right.
So STCs don't play a role in this.
Well, they probably do. But so you can imagine now if you have a whole population of these now. So as you shear it, some of these may be participating in STCs and so causing these force chains to fail, but there won't be this collective failure that leads to a large cascade of slips. And so statistically over the whole, most of these chains are deforming and bending, but there may be some where there's isolated points of failure that are occurring, but it's not enough to get the whole system.
So there are these experiments by Beringer, right?
Right.
They show that the force chains don't, if you look at the force chains going through the shear band, you don't even know that there's a shear band.
Exactly.
That they do fail in the shear bands through rotations.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to interpret that as an STZ, maybe that's an STZ, mm-hmm. but they fail through rotations.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, so now that we've sort of investigated this thing, I think we can look back to this question, why do we see more frequent recurrence at higher normal stresses and lower normal stresses? Well, the basic idea is, if the material needs to dilate a fixed amount to fail, if it dilates more rapidly at large normal stresses, then there's going to be less time before it fails. And so based on that, you can get this 1 over normal stress scaling out of this this dilation scaling. And so that tells us that the recurrence time should scale approximately as 1 over the normal stress. But notice that's not perfect because dilation depends on the slip rather than the time. And so since there's a period of time when the material is stuck and not sliding, that's going to give some deviations between recurrence time and slip between events, which is really what's going to give this 1 over normal stress dependence. And you can also look at the thickness scaling of recurrence time. We expect to see that once we remove this normal stress dependence, that there should be a linear scaling in the recurrence time as a function of thickness. And see that part of the data does show that, but there's also some things out here that aren't quite following that. And once again, this is probably an effect of the fact that dilation is controlled by slip rather than time. And so, so that's not going to give you this perfect scaling. So an interesting thing that comes out of this is if a thicker fault should have longer recurrence times, well, we see that in the Earth, thickness scaling occurs because we have what are called mature faults. So these are faults that have slipped more, crushed up more rock, and formed thicker granular layers. Those tend to have longer recurrence times. They tend to have less frequent earthquakes than immature faults, which are faults that haven't crushed up as much rock and formed as thicker granular layer. So that's certainly in somewhat of agreement with this scaling that we observe here. Okay, so just to kind of recap some of the implications this has for constituent models. So note that we find that layer dilation plays an important role in the failure, and that so obviously that means it's going to be an important state variable in any sort of constituent model, be it the effective temperature, free volume, or what have you. So notice this was independent of normal stress and thickness, but it did have dependence on the driving velocity. So this may be an indication that we have some rate-dependent effective temperature that we're evolving towards. But we should have some caution with that because these are transient measurements rather than measurements of steady state behavior. And so I think it certainly means that we're on the right track with this, but we should certainly investigate a little bit more and see what we can get out of these types of experiments. So we saw that this dilation rate has a scaling with both the normal stress and with the layer thickness. So this implies that the frictional length scale should also depend on the thickness and the normal stress. And the scaling that comes out of that is the length should scale like the thickness squared and inversely with the normal stress. And so what this implies is that for seismic faults, they should be larger than lab values because we have this squared power in the thickness rather than just a single power on the normal stress. And this also confirms that there's this rate dependence of this length scale that we mentioned before that's not captured by Dietrich arena friction. Finally, there's this observation that we see dilation in the prior to failure that's not dependent on the thickness, and this dilation rate which is. So one can take that as meaning that there's localization, but also the entire layer plays a role in dynamics. So my cartoon picture for that is some images from Bob Berenger's lab where they have a slider that they're dragging over a granular material to look at stick slip. What they find is that most of the rearrangements occur very near to the top of the material here in this region. But we also notice that since they image these force networks in these experiments, you can see that it obviously spreads all throughout the material. And so the material dynamics may depend on this entire thickness due to these force chains that propagate all the way throughout, even though most of the deformation is occurring in this region that's localized. So I think that's it. So just to recap what we've talked about here. So I looked at some of the dilation of layers in these stick slip experiments, found that dilation is controlled by the slip, and the rate scales with the normal stress and inversely with the thickness. There's definitely some, the evolution depends on the dissipation rate. Recurrence time scales with the normal stress and with layer thickness on these experiments. And there's this thickness dynamics that both are dependent on the thickness and not dependent on the thickness. And so there may be both localized and other broader processes that are important. So I'm happy to answer any further questions people have, and thank you for your attention. Yeah?
So I'm going to come back to this connection. So the last scaling law you showed about for L, which is the square over sigma n.
Yeah.
And your recurrence time goes as 1 over sigma n.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my initial intuition that those two are related.
Okay.
It's the, you know, it's, again, has to do with the stress building up or the force strains building up or whatever, but that sets your length scale for that and the system size.
Yeah.
How do you understand the regularity of the sticks? Yeah. I mean, people have done many simulations for layers of grains that are comparable in thickness to the one you have, and what you see is obviously stick speed, but it's very irregular.
Yeah, so that may be a fact that a lot of these a lot of the simulations are done in 2D. I don't know if you're thinking of ones that were in 2D versus 3D, but. So it may be that certainly in lab experiments, if you do it. So in Chris's apparatus, they did some experiments where they used 2D rods versus 3D spheres, and they found there was differences in the friction that they measured. And there was much more regularity in the friction for 2D rods rather than 3D spheres. And so it may be something related to that. You know, that it may not be the case, because I know there's simulation that people have done in both 2D and 3D.
Are they worried about the stiffness of their apparatus? Because, I mean,
there may be that, some effect like that as well.
Might depend sensitively on the precise values of the parameters. You can enter either regime. But what is the right one?
Yeah, Karen.
In the simple models, at least, you get this very regular, these very regular large events if you have a weakening effect. If you have, like they have in their law, that basically, once it slips, it's weaker, which I guess in this case could be the dilation. You could contribute to that. So then you get the very regular stick slip events with large. Your large slip events are pretty much system spanning, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you would expect, I think, that this, at least from the simple models, that these precursors before the big events, that they may be, possibly parallel with the cutoff. And the less flat the curve gets at the end, the smaller the cutoff. So that basically, that they are very irregular, the precursors.
Yeah, the precursors are definitely more irregular. I think that's a good point, Karen.
Right, and actually, there is a question. In the models, at least, you can get mode switching if you make the weakening during the large event less strong. Now, I'm not quite sure how you would make it less strong. But say if you would allow less dilation somehow or something, you could maybe make it the weakening less strong. And then in the models, at least, you can see sort of like several periods of stick slip, and then suddenly it switches into a phase where you get irregular behavior, and then it can switch back again. So I know that I think Karen Daniels saw that in some of
their. Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
Interesting to see if you can see that here too.
Yeah, so I'm not being experimentalist. Certainly, we're working with Chris's group on trying to get some of the more measurements there and stuff that we're interested in looking at from a data analysis theoretical standpoint. So, yeah, there's certainly a lot of interesting ways we can go from there.
They can't really look in and see what happens when the slip occurs.
So I know that one of Chris's students has been doing, so they can do things where they look at the material after it's slipped. You know, so they put an epoxy in there and they actually look at the structures. But you can't, it's hard to when you're looking at these 3D materials in this apparatus, it's hard to get a handle on the microscopics of that, which is why I think, employing simulations that capture some of the same macroscopic dynamics we see may be more valuable in terms of.
Do real granular simulations. Why don't you try to employ David Waits?
Actually, one of Peter Schall's postdocs right now is working on a dilation, or she's doing a shearing experiment with large PMMA, so as a granular material, basically, with a laser sheet to scan all the positions, but with a load cell on top, so varying pressure and measuring the dilation of the thing. So I don't know if that's. I'll just tell you what everyone else is doing. But yeah, it's a cool experiment.
But in 2D, they certainly can visualize. So do you really believe that 2D is so different from 3D?
Yeah, but this is not 2D. This
I know.
It was very clear that you've got a whole lot of grains in that layer, and that must make a big difference.
Is the total slip in the case where you have higher normal stress, so where you have less precursors and then the big one, right? Is the total slip in the big events bigger?
No, it does not depend on the normal slip. I think I have a plot for that. Yeah, so here's slip during failure as a function of normal stress, and there is not very much difference. You tend to see hysteresis in it later in the experiment. So these green these green points are later in the experiment when the normal stress is decreasing. Those tend to be less. But certainly as you increase the normal stress or decrease the normal stress, you know, the fact it's increasing or decreasing may be important, but it doesn't seem like the total value changes the slip very much. At least in terms of how I calculate it here. And that's obviously has some assumptions associated with it, but yeah.
Slips are also smaller than a grain size.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Just for clarification, when you vary normal stress, you shear your system, so the shear stress must vary linearly with also proportional to normal stress, the stress for shearing.
Say that one more time.
If you increase, when you always speak of the normal stresses, but in fact it's all the stresses that you need to scale, no?
Yeah.
So it's the scale of the stresses and also the shear stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the friction coefficient is
fairly constant.
I showed that earlier in the experiment. It's about 0.4.
Ratio
of shear stress to normal stress. Yeah, that's the friction coefficient that arises from that doesn't change very much too, as you vary the normal stress. Yeah.
Could you vary the size of the grains?
They have done that. I don't have any data from that.
Drop depend on that.
I could ask them. I haven't looked at that myself, but they certainly have done experiments both varying the grain size and looking at a more polydisperse beads, and also in looking at angular particles. So they've done a lot. So certainly those things are important for the Earth, because in the Earth we see angular, the 3D particles. You know, so it's important to understand the differences between that and some of the simpler geometries that people use to study this. Yeah.
The size of the glass beads again?
125 microns on average.
What's the margins of the beads?
I'm not sure if I know that. Are you asking of the individual beads or from the pack as a whole?
Yeah, just individual. I'm trying to understand its megapascals and figures.
Yeah, I'm not sure. So they're made of glass, so that it would be a way to get a first order estimation. But I don't know that off the top of my head, unfortunately.
The question beyond this experiment, but in real seismic events, water and materials, nature, clay, and stuff like that coming in. Right? So how do they affect the analysis? How this analysis relates to the real seismic event?
Yeah, well, that's obviously the million-dollar question here. People have certainly done experiments looking at moisture and how that plays a role in various, you know, using actual fault materials rather than, you know, these simple glass bead experiments. And there certainly are a lot of different experiments that have looked at that. In terms of, you know, in this apparatus for comparison with this, I know they've done stuff, and I don't know it off the top of my head. But yeah, so certainly those are important questions in terms of thinking about the Earth. Once we have a basic understanding of the physics of failure and deformation in these materials, how do these additional physical and chemical processes come into play?
So to me, I'm surprised at how small your slips are.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a lot of times when you're trying to get more to a seismic regime, you wouldn't be thinking about moving the ring.
Right. Yes, that's very true.
I'm surprised that you're in a regime that your failure is that.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say anything about that? Have you looked at other loading methods?
So I know that, you know, so for instance, they have a very stiff load cell at the top of their apparatus, so that but they've also, you know, say put a hockey puck in there, something more compliant, to try and change the compliance of the apparatus. Maybe that, you know, certainly if you're thinking about the compliance of the apparatus versus its size relative to the Earth, where you have, so we're talking about rocks which have much larger moduli, but since we're talking about bigger systems, they're actually more compliant, so which is why that's you're going to get more slip in a given earthquake due to that. So, changing things like that would be the way to try and get at having more slip in events or, something like that to address that aspect of the question.
Any idea whether these slips are spatially homogeneous? Any clue about whether it's a whole layer that's just one?
I think so.
Or is it something else?
I mean, I think that based on the acoustic emission, looking at the sort of the creep events versus slip events, the change in the magnitude of the acoustic emission that they see, I think it gives you some sort of clue that we're thinking about the whole system. So they have roughened boundaries to make sure that there's no boundary slip that's occurring.
So they're pretty sure there's no boundary slip.
Yeah.
How do they make those rough boundaries?
I'm not sure. So Paul's been meaning to take me out to Penn State to see this apparatus, because I certainly have lots of things I want to look at and understand about this. Yeah, two isolated places is impossible to get from one to the other.
Or indeed from anywhere.
The reason I ask is just thinking about sort of, we talked about the compliance of the whole thing, mm-hmm. but then if you have fine structures that are on your boundary,
yeah.
that may be a different issue as far
right.
as people
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
Also, if you think the whole event, it totally might be a function.
Yeah.
That might depend on the length, does it?
That's when you say so. What the thickness or the size of the?
Well, not the thickness, but the whole length of this apparatus.
So I'm not sure if they've looked at that. I'm not sure if they can look at that either.
I think the more interesting would be to make the width 10 or 100 times.
Right, so that's certainly, at least for me, thinking about seismic faults, because the question of how you scale something that's very small to something that extends over hundreds of kilometers, that's a really big question. And coming up with something to explore. I know that in Bob Berenger's lab, they've looked at stick slip with a boat that changes in length. So that may be the place to start with this. I know, Paul collaborates with Bob as well, so we may be able to talk to Bob about that and have that as some sort of indicator for how things are going to scale with the physical extent of the fault.
These beads are pretty spherical, I gather.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Is there any understanding of how big a role granular material that's more faceted?
Oh yeah, so they definitely do not see the stick slip events if you have angular materials. Those seem to tend to just slide stably instead of failing in a stick slip manner like this.
Wait. Berenger has experiments with pentagons.
Right.
They have stick slip.
Right, so it may be we're in a regime here with this apparatus where these angular particles don't have stick slip.
What shape they are?
They're not shaped. They're rough. They're like natural rocks. Yeah, like sand, for instance. Yeah. So with those in this apparatus, they don't see stick slip. They see it just tends to slide stably.
I have a question on your. You mentioned the modulus, right? After slip.
Mm-hmm.
Does that number make sense? Do you know what it is? Can you interpret it?
Yeah. So I have a. So I think it ends up being fairly similar. So this is the stiffness. Yeah. So it's very similar to the stiffness of the apparatus that Chris has measured, where they don't put any grains in there, just of the steel blocks themselves of the setup. So it's similar in magnitude to that, to the number that we get out of this, and it scales with the normal stress at least up to these higher values here.
In the case where they had these very irregular materials, have mm-hmm. they done statistics in the events in that case?
Well, they don't see stick slip, so I'm not sure that you can do a similar.
Do they see smaller events that have some interesting distribution?
Well, it slides stably, but it's not perfectly stable. There are fluctuations. I'm not sure if those are large or small compared to just general fluctuations you see in their system. I'm yeah, so that's something that I haven't looked at at all, and I'm not sure if they've done much with that either.
And then I have one other question. I think you said this, but I missed it. The slip as a function of thickness of your layer. You showed it as a function of model stress. Is a function of thickness of the layer?
Do I have that? I probably figure it out if I think about it. I don't think there's much scaling with that. Or at least it's certainly, so the way that you could see that is, the trend in the experiment is, this is earlier, this, and then the green is later, and it goes like this. So there's not a whole, if there was some dependence on thickness, you would expect these to be further apart than these over here. They don't appear to have a whole lot of difference that. So I don't have a plot that shows that, but I don't think there's very much variation with the thickness, at least in the ranges explored here. Maybe that if for much thicker layer, I know they have some experiments for things that are a factor of two thicker, and those may. Well, I haven't looked at those, so I wouldn't want to say something that I haven't looked at yet.
I want to say something more about that stiffness.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I mean, stiffness is megapascals, not megapascals per micron, right? So can you get the shear modulus of that layer from this? Can you make sense out of that?
So I've looked at that, and I'm not sure that I have something that it's satisfying to me yet.
That was really my question. So
yeah.
Is it low? Is it, how does it look?
It certainly is. I think it's low, it seems to me. So part of it is that you have some stiffness of the apparatus plus some elastic stiffness of the grains. And so
actually what the stiffness of that little layer.
Right.
Is.
So
is something about the packet, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So what can you make out of that?
So let's see. So given the stiffness that I know of the apparatus.
You have to know something about the beads and their modulus and the contact and all of that. There must be theories about this.
Yeah, so there certainly are theories looking at how, say, with the normal stress, how does this wave speed scale, for instance.
Independently of that, I think, just how it compares to the stiffness of the individual beads.
Right, yeah. Okay. Right, yeah. Yeah, so I found that trying to deconvolve this into stiffness of the various aspects is, I think some more measurements from the lab might be helpful in addressing that. So are there? Yeah.
One last question, just to clarify, in the setup, what happens at the ends? Do grains come out at the end? Does it pull?
So they have these. So I think that at the bottom they have some sort of a Teflon spacer that should keep them from falling out, and then they have something to keep them in there. But there's definitely some stretch as you shear it. Obviously, you're going to be spreading these things out over a larger and larger region as you shear that. So that you don't lose material, but it certainly doesn't. There are ways that they have to control it to try and keep it where they want it to be. That's certainly one of the experimental challenges of trying to shear these materials in this case.
That's right.
Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Thank you all for coming.